So it's on.
So I mean, it's your power after
the fall. I don't know if you're going to make it, but the final pitch, I still have my connection to kind of go. So, energy futures, all global, my plan for companies. So these are end users that are natural gas. Natural gas and power, did some diesel trades, cap and trade stuff, pretty much. California power is very nice. Natural gas is all the most important thing. I arbitrage in that. I get. I don't know how much.
I'm not in an area, but in the area, know her.
So
that's a crazy area.
The most volatile markets in the world. Yeah. So equities close once a day. My power markets close every 10 minutes. 10 minute intervals.
Oh man, that's a rush.
It was great for a guy in his early 20s. Everyone left
okay, the Joel,
after
Joel and Jared.
And I was a large person.
So he preached to us.
Anyway, I did that energy deal, and everyone was leaving. I had no business being there. I left that and then started full time ministry, and then He was just telling me about being a CPA and a pastor. And I was like, what do you do in March? You here this evening?
No,
I'll be heading out after this, but I'll be back tomorrow. I'll be back tomorrow. I have another 11 o'clock in this room.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, I was hoping to get some consulting from you.
Like free consultation?
Hey, if I could get you here. Reach out to me, Sam at churchcancer.com. Okay. All right. Just email me. We'll figure something out.
Okay.
Sure. Afternoon. So I assume we're supposed to start at 2:30.
Yes.
Okay. So this is business calculus. If you're in if that's not the syllabus in front of you, you're in the wrong room. This takes me back, being in a more of a classroom.
Oh,
so this
I was
is
just
great.
In a classroom, had the desktop on the chair. So
here's the deal. And this works last session. I have no idea if it'll work this session. But we're just going to kind of go back and forth. And if you have questions, raise your hand. Like, if you're like, are the Tampa Bay Rays ever going to fix Tropicana Field? I mean, I can, you know, give you my perspective on that. But
what's on the final exam?
What's that?
What's on the final exam?
Let's be on the test.
The point of the final exam is to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, okay, from Jesus. That's the final exam.
I just have a question. How well do you and your dad get along? I love watching your talking together when you guys do videos, by the way.
So we get along great. He is an amazing man of God. That is not a shtick. That is how we are. So when we do webinars or podcasts or whatever, there's no editing. There's no nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you're just basically sitting at the table with us as if it was Thanksgiving and we're just going back and forth. But does he annoy me sometimes? Yeah, he does. He's my dad. Do I annoy him? I'm sure I do. But, you know, I'm 45. He's turning 70 this year. I'm blessed. Some of you have wonderful relationship with your parents or with your kids, and some of you don't, right? So I'm very blessed to be able to work with him at Church Answers. I don't take it lightly. And I do realize that my last name, because of him, carries a little bit of weight. But he didn't make it big until I was 25. So I was already in a house. I'd been living by myself. And I was in the corporate world. So, like, he started making it when I was already on my own. So some people think, oh, you must have been crazy to grow up with Tom Rainer. I was like, we were dirt poor. Like, we were struggling inner city people. I grew up in an apartment of 450 square feet. So, yeah, I live in two worlds. I have the world of my childhood, which was great. It wasn't a bad childhood, but we were just really, really poor. And then now it's like, well, everybody knows who you are. I'm like, really? I'm just glad I get to go to McDonald's or White Castles.
Yeah.
You guys have White Castles, and that is my favorite.
Oh, yes. All of
love
them.
White Castles. We have one in Florida. We have the largest White Castle in Orlando, because it's Orlando, of course. So come on in, guys. Come on in. Where's my host? Where's the host?
And we're middle room.
Yeah, I know. It was Jill. She had to leave.
Okay. Does anybody know when I'm supposed to stop?
We have to be back.
The Holy Spirit was 15 minutes earlier than you were planning.
We have to be back at 3:45.
The next session is 3:45.
So
3:30.
So 3:30.
Yeah. We have to be back to the church at 3:45.
Okay. Okay. So we'll go about 45 minutes or so. Okay. Yeah. There's nothing worse than like being held captive by a speaker because he's just got or she's got one more thing to say, right? I don't want to do that to you. So, this will not be a hostage situation. Come on in. Come on in. Glad to have everybody. All right, so to get us started, I know this is the spitting table right here.
Oh, okay.
At this point, I should probably take a sip of water, right? Just for you guys. All right, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get out your phones or write the address down, whatever you want to do. And I want you to punch, if you have Google Maps, Google Maps if you're sanctified, Apple products if you're not, just pull up. You can tell which side of the fence I'm on. I want you to just punch your church address in there and just look at your neighborhood for a moment. Or write the address down, whatever you want to do. Just get a visual. Get a visual on your church. Get a visual on your church address. And if you've been there for any amount of time, I mean, you know what you're looking at. But for the purposes of this activity, I want you to just get a sense of your location. Your church address is not an accident. We got room, guys. Come on in. If not, we'll make room. Come sit by me. Yeah, a couple seats over here, one over there, one back there. This is good practice for your church when things start, you know, when you start growing and you got to make seats and stuff, right?
He's right up by the teacher.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
No, you're
really not.
Well, you know we're Methodist, so we always have our assigned seats. So as long as nobody takes our assigned seat.
Gotcha. Gotcha. You want to sit by me? You want this chair?
No, I don't. I appreciate it, though.
We'll make room. We'll make room. I've got a chair over here. Somebody's willing to sit there.
This is good, standing room only.
I know it is.
I do follow you.
Come on in, guys. Come on in. I want you to sit on the floor. I've got one chair here, right next to me. Right next to me. Or you can pull it back closer if you want to sit next to somebody or what have you. All right, your church address is not an accident. You can take the chair if you need it for real.
Thank you.
And you don't have to sit there. Is that your wife? Yeah, you should sit next to her, not next to me. So you're looking at your phone. You've got a visual on where you are. You've got your location. You've got your address, or you wrote it down, or whatever it is. The point that I want to make is that God has sovereignly placed you there. I believe in the power of God in bringing people to where they are. Now, you may say, you don't know my story. It's happenstance. You would not believe how I got to my church or my home or my place or wherever it is. Listen, people ask me, how'd you get to West Bradenton? And the short answer is God. The long answer, and I don't have time to tell the story because it would take the whole time to tell the story, is, well, I got fired from my last church. And they were God told me to go to the first church that offered me a job. So I did. How'd you get to West Bradenton? Well, I was unemployed, and they offered me a job. My wife was 4 months pregnant, soon to be three little kids, and I stood up against the power group. I didn't do anything wrong. Like, what do you do? I didn't do anything wrong, but I stood up against the power group, and they were like, see you later.
Yeah.
Because you can do that in Baptist world, by the way. That's what they did. So it was quite a journey, and maybe you've had quite a journey too, but you are where you are because God has placed you there. And your church has an address for a reason, and that reason is that you will reach your neighborhood. So we're going to be talking about the neighborhood church, the possibility, or I hope the probability, of a comeback of the neighborhood church. So let me just tell you a little bit about our location. It's 1305 43rd Street West in Bradenton, Florida. And your community is going to be different than mine, of course, but we're about 45% ethnic minority, mainly Hispanic, some black. So we're about half and half white and ethnic minority. We all get along well in our community, thankfully. We're in a good place there. 43% of the population is under 40. A lot of people think Florida is older. It can be, certainly, but in our case, about 43% of the population is under 40, and we have about 250,000 people that live 15 minutes from our church. Mm-hmm. So we're not quite an urban area, but close. We're definitely not suburban. It's like a crammed up coastal community of Florida, as I like to call it. If you've ever been to my part of the country, you know. Like driving around here, it's just like wide open spaces. It's just like, wow. It's really pretty. I've never been to this part of Michigan, so it's nice. I've been to Muskegon in Holland. I've been to Detroit. I won't tell you which one I like better. But the Detroit Tigers are doing well. So, you know, good for you guys. Good for you guys. I don't have a problem with the Tigers. I do have a problem with the Yankees. But hopefully there's none of you Yankees fans in here. What God began at my church, what God began in 1956, 54, depends on who you ask. But what God began there is not supposed to stop until Christ returns. And I believe it's supposed to happen at 1305 43rd Street West. So here I am. I'm a pastor. I need to lead my church hoping that Christ comes back soon, but knowing he may tarry for another 100 years, right? So I have to lead at knowing that whatever I build needs to be sustainable. It needs to be something that the neighborhood, that we're going to be there in that neighborhood ministering for the next 100 years. That's how you have to lead a church. So I don't want flash in the pan stuff. I don't want to grow just to grow. I don't want to steal from a bunch of other churches. I want to do something that's actually going to make an impact in my neighborhood, because it's not my kingdom, it's his kingdom come. What God began at your church the day it was planted is supposed to continue until Christ returns. So I want to take you to a verse. I'm going to have a few less stats, although I'm going to do some synthesis of research in this session, and we can talk. If you have questions, again, raise your hand. It'd be fine. Matthew 24:14. I want to take you there. When I read it, you'll probably know the passage. Matthew 24:14. And the good news about the kingdom will be preached. Future imperative tense. Will be preached. Where? Throughout the whole world. Why? So that all nations will hear it, and then the end will come. Now, we could talk eschatology if you want, although many of you would probably run circles around me with that particular topic. And this is an eschatological verse, right? I mean, this is like, when will the end happen? That's a big question, and there's a lot of debate around that. But all the nations must hear. So I understand the eschatological implications of this verse, but I want to talk about the practical urgency that we must have if we truly believe this verse. So I want to talk about panta ta ethne. That's the Greek, right? Panta ta ethne. All nations. Or all the nations. If we are going to go to all the people, all the nations, we've got to be willing to cross boundaries. So, you've got these yards out here, which the grass is very pretty, by the way. And these used to be homes, but obviously it looks like the university or church or something has has taken them over. But there used to be somebody who lives there and somebody who lives there. And they'd have to mow their yards, right? This time of year, you're mowing your yard. And there's an invisible line, because there's no fence, where you're supposed to stop mowing. And then sometimes neighbors argue over that, right? Like, you know, they get all upset about yards. And then in Florida, our grass grows like an inch an hour. So you can't let it go too long. And, you know, your neighbor mows, and then, like, you've got 24 hours to respond, right? My point is, sometimes the hardest boundary to cross is that boundary. The invisible line where the grass ends, your grass ends and your neighbor's grass begins. But the lines can be many different things, right? It can be a geopolitical line. You know, our church is all over the world. We have mission partners in several places: India, Belize, Guatemala, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Peru, Rwanda. Several places I'm not supposed to say. Armenia, we're smuggling Bibles into Iran, but my mission pastor were here, he'd be like, stop it! I'm not supposed to say anything like that. But I want to brag about you guys. And I love where my church goes. So, but sometimes it's easier to get on a plane and go to India than it is to like cross the line in the yard and actually go invite somebody to church. Mm-hmm. But that's our calling. We've got to cross those boundaries.
There's the missionary call. Where's the missionary call? The missionary call is your neighbor. The missionary call is the nations. So boundaries can be language, socioeconomics, ethnicity. It can be all sorts of things. But is your church willing? Are you willing to cross that boundary, whatever that boundary may be for you, so that all peoples or all the nations can hear? And notice, verse 14, it doesn't say that the gospel should be preached or might be preached, right? It says the gospel will be preached. So God will use someone, somehow, some way. Is he going to use you? The great confession reminds us that Jesus is central to everything. The great commandment reminds us to love God with everything we have, to love our neighbor as ourselves. The great commission reminds us to make disciples of all nations. This verse is the great confidence. The church will go, the people will hear, and people will be saved. I am fully confident every time I share my faith that the gospel has saving power to it and that person has the potential of being saved. Anybody I share with. Now, will they or not? That's their decision. I can't force that on them. I can't myself be the Holy Spirit work in somebody. But I certainly have confidence in the work of the Spirit and in the fact that people will be saved. So I like to be very positive. Like when my church does stuff, I like to tell my people, I'm an eternal optimist. Man, God's going to work. We don't know how. We don't know when. We don't even know all the details. But he will work. The gospel will be preached. So Matthew 24:14 is a promise. And you are God's promise to the nations. And you are God's promise to your neighbors. Your church address is not an accident. God has placed you there for a reason. Your home address is not an accident. You were there so that people will be reached. I tell my people that all the time. Like, your home address is not an accident. Go and share. Go and share. So I'll never forget. So when we moved to Bradenton, we moved into a home off 67th. We now live off 75th, but that's neither here nor there. But we moved into the house off 67th. You know, you've got a big van out front or a truck, and there was a for sale sign. Now it's not there. It's obvious you're new, right? You're at least new to the neighborhood. Which, by the way, teach your people this, please. Oh, house is for sale. You may not even know who lived there before. House is for sale. Okay, the sign goes down. There's a truck out front. That's your cue to go over there. Bring cookies. Hey, do you need help? I've got a strong back, or I've got someone I know who's got a strong back. Can I help you put a bed together? You know, it's like, well, that's a little creepy. I don't care. I'm an extrovert, and I will annoy all of you introverts. And I just will. You know how it's good for you, right? But when they're moving in or shortly thereafter, go knock on the door. Hey, you're new. I have no idea who you are. I don't know if you're new to the community or if you moved from another house. I just want to know, I'm glad you're here. I brought you a gift. Hey, I'm right over there. If you need anything, go knock on my door. You know, you'll see my kids or my grandkids or whatever. Go meet the neighbors. Be a good neighbor. So anyway, I was trying to do that. When we moved into our house and we're outside and I met Tamara. Tamara is her name. So we exchanged the typical pleasantries, right? So I'm just trying to meet all the people around me. And there was Tamara literally right next door and houses in Florida. Like everything's so spread out. Like our houses are right next to each other. We're going back and forth as you would expect. Just normal stuff, where are you from, how long you've been here, all that. And then she asked me my favorite question. Whenever people exchange pleasantries, it's my favorite question. It's, what do you do for a living? Because I get two different answers, but it's the same word. Two different answers, but the same word. I said, what do you do for a living? I'm like, I'm a pastor. And I get, oh. Or I get, oh, and it's like, okay, I know where you stand on this. Like, so anyway, but she did something. She did something I've never had anybody do, not before or since. But what do you do? I said, well, I'm a pastor, Tamara. And she goes, put up her fingers like an X, hissed at me. I started walking away. And I was like, Tamara, I'm a pastor, not a vampire. That's literally what I told her. I could give you a long story there. She was very antagonistic, very caustic, very hard to deal with, but Tamara eventually came to know Jesus Christ as a personal person. Not because of me. There's a church down the road that wanted a Christ, although I was working on it. If you have a high regard for the sovereignty of God, you must also have a practical urgency about the Great Commission. If you really believe in who God is, you will really do what he tells you to do. Now, I write a lot about this in The Surprising Return of the Neighborhood Church. If you want to check out that book, you can. And that's kind of where I want to camp a little bit, because I do think we're at an inflection point. An inflection point with a movement of churches in the United States. So I've talked about some personal stuff. I want to pull up now and talk about some macro stuff, and hopefully it will apply to you. And I don't want to sound too negative about large churches or mega churches or anything like that. If you are a faithful, Bible-believing church and you're winning people to the Lord, I don't care if you're a house church or mega church or whatever. God needs all kinds of churches in this nation. And I'm just happy you're faithfully teaching the Word of God, making disciples, and winning people to Christ. So what I'm about to share with you, I don't want it to come across as negative against large churches, but there are some things that are happening, and I think it's important for all of you to know, because generally speaking, the Global Methodist Church is more small, mid-sized churches, neighborhood churches, churches that are kind of buried in communities, towns like this. And that's where most of you are. So if you're like, I'm the mega church pastor, I don't mean offense. I really don't. But things are changing. So what we are seeing happen, the mega church movement, most people don't know this, because most of the researchers that are doing mega church research, it's to their benefit to make the mega church look good. Mm-hmm. So I know these guys. They're actually good guys. They're good guys and gals. But they don't often tell you the negative side of things. So I'm going to do that, though. So the mega church movement peaked in 2012. And I can show you the data, and you could probably Google that in some of the articles that I've written. That'll pop up. But or you could read The Surprising Return of the Neighborhood Church. Right around 2012, there was about 1,800 mega churches. It's really hard to count churches in the United States, just so you know. Like, how many churches are there in the U.S.? I think there's 400,000, because, like, you don't know that house church exists. Nobody knows to call them, right? But that's a church. So somewhere around 2012, there was about 1,800 mega churches in that range. Today, and I'm currently digging into databases, and I'm going to find the number, but my estimate is that we're now under 1,000, or right at 1,000 megachurches.
How many did you say it was?
1,800, somewhere in that range.
Sorry, is there sort of a definition of what would be considered a megachurch?
Megachurch is 2,000 average weekly attenders, typically averaged over the course of a year. So 52 weeks. Not membership. Some pastor like, I'm a mega church pastor. You have 2,000 members on the roll, but you have 50 people showing up. But active weekly attenders. Some of these researchers are trying to change the definition down to like 1,600, because that way they can say there are more mega churches. There's a hand in the back. Surprising Return of the Neighborhood Church by Rainer, R-A-I-N-E-R. So what happened was, and there's other researchers who have done this. Chavez is one, if you know Chavez's research. In the 1970s, baby boomers started moving out of mainline churches and into these larger non-denominational churches. Some of you felt that. You were part of the UMC. It's like, yeah, I lived that, or I was a part of that. I saw that. So we saw this exodus of baby boomers starting in the 70s, But more in the 80s and 90s and into the early 2000s, they started transferring into larger churches. Typically non-denominational churches, some of them Southern Baptist churches. And that's how they grew. And if you look at the data of larger churches, many of, well, most of them, the predominant growth engine for them was transfer growth. That's just data. That's just facts. Again, there are good examples of large churches that have won a lot of people to Christ and have done it the right way. But that's how a lot of these large churches grew. It was largely a baby boomer phenomenon. Go into these churches today and you will find that they are filled with baby boomers. They are. So I say all that. So the number of megachurches is going down. The average age within a megachurch is going up. A lot of people point to these like really happening young, large churches. They are out there, but that's not most of them, okay? So something else has to be coming, is my point. So this movement, which I don't think megachurch is just going to go away. There's still this idea that most people go to the largest churches, right? So the church of 2,000 is now like 5,000, or the church of 5,000 like 10,000. So, you know, but just imagine, what if we took 10,000 people and created how many of our churches out of like 100 people, 200 people, and they each had their own pastor in a neighborhood? The scope of impact,
yes, would be
greater. That could be, it would be so much greater, so much greater. But I think you as Global Methodists have that opportunity. Right? I really do. So I want to talk about the rise of the neighborhood church. I want to talk about what could be. I'm not going to say it will be. I'm going to talk about what could be. If you do what you're supposed to do, I think God's going to use you. I think he's going to use your churches. But you can't sit back and go, well, the megachurch movement's fading. Some researcher told me that. So when are these people going to show up? When they come into my service, well, they're not unless they're invited. They're not unless you're running good programs. They're not unless you've got discipleship going on. They're not unless you're sharing your faith. You've got to cross those boundaries.
Yes.
That's what you're going to have to do. So let's talk really practical now. Let's talk about the rise of the neighborhood church. And if I were doing slides, this would be kind of my first point. Reality of real estate. I actually, from Detroit, flew into Detroit, kind of drove through some of the countryside over here and through some of the small towns, and I forget which names, but I stopped in some of them, and I just love looking at where the churches are. And unfortunately, in a lot of these towns around here, and some of you guys live here, you know this, right? All boarded up. Now, I understand towns struggle, and that, you know, people leave, and there's, you know, the Rust Belt cities have had issues with that. I understand that. I'm not talking about that. I have no idea. The names aren't even on the signs of these churches. I have no idea. I have no clue what they were doing or what they weren't doing or what tribe they were a part of. All that I know is that there are still people in that town, obviously. And the churches are boarded up. Mm-hmm. And those churches on some of the most strategic real estate in the Great Lakes region, right? Mm-hmm. Corners of streets that, like, that's a prime. Why was it there in the first place? Because it's a prime location. So I hear, like, people say, oh, there's a church on every street corner in that town. I'm like, praise the Lord. Why are we lamenting that? Wouldn't it be great if there was a little, like a church of 50, a church of 100, church of 200, church of 300, church of 50, like on every corner in each of these neighborhoods around here? Wouldn't that be awesome? That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the design that God has. These grid patterns exist for a reason. Let's use them for the glory of God. So you go to Manhattan, like high rises, and then there's like the church, right? It's very ornate and old and all that stuff, but it's still there. Like, well, John D. Rockefeller built that one. And it's more of a tourist site than it is an actual congregation. But location-wise, some of the most expensive real estate in the nation is held by churches. We cannot lose these kingdom assets. And you may say, well, my church property is not that valuable, but yeah, it's buried in a neighborhood. And it used to be, that used to be a negative thing, right? We're not off the main drag. How's anyone going to find us? Well, guess what? Nobody just, very rare that somebody's driving and they're like, oh, look, a church, let's go there. Nobody does that anymore. How do you find anything now? You just look it up. So if you invite people, what church? Okay, and you punch it up. Here's our address and punch it in. It'll just take you there. You don't have to worry about the fact that you're not off the main drag anymore. And who is best situated to reach that local school, that local elementary school that's right down the road? It's your neighborhood church. I think it's prime for a comeback. But these neighborhood churches are actually have to do the work. There's the reality of real estate. And then there's this invisible opportunity that I mentioned in my plenary session about hospitality. It is true that the smaller you are, the better you have to be at hospitality, right? If I go to a big sporting event, I don't expect high levels of hospitality. I expect high levels of efficiency. But if I show up at your house and you don't even say anything and I just walk in and sit on your sofa, that's just weird, right? So if you're like, well, we have 50, 60, 75 people in my church, when somebody is new and they show up to that, you had better be all over that. It's like, we're the friendliest church in town with each other. Yeah. I see it all the time in my church. Like, someone who is obviously new, they're like, nobody talks to them, and they're like, they go sit down in the worship space, and they're like looking at the stained glass, and it's like, you've obviously never been here before. They're like sitting by themselves. I have deacons in my church. Go sit next to that person. What are you doing?
Forced to sit in the front row.
Yeah.
Right.
And a lot of time, your new people are the ones who are early. It's your regulars who are like struggling to get in. So my point is, and it's millennials, Gen X not so much, but millennials and Gen Z, we kind of have these terms we just overuse. It's like, we want it to be authentic. Like, what does that even mean? But my generation values intimacy just as much as grandness. Just as much. Now, is the big mega church show attractive? Of course it is. All the programs they have and all the research, of course. But the younger generations will value that intimacy, that hospitality, that friendship, that genuineness just as much as grandness. But if you don't do that, you're missing the opportunity. So the invisible opportunity, if this is point two, the invisible opportunity is hospitality. We struggle with hospitality in our society right now, particularly post-COVID. And that's not a knock against anybody in the service industry. I'm staying at a hotel, and there's like one guy doing everything there. And like, he can't give me high levels of service. Of course he can't. I feel for the guy. Like, he's been pulled in 100 different directions with 100 different people. You know, a lot of these service industry places are understaffed. They're just understaffed. And that's why they can't offer good service. But what if your church was the place when everyone showed up on a Sunday morning? It's like, wow, you really stand out in our society right now because nobody's doing hospitality well. Like, nobody. Visible opportunity is hospitality. Let's talk about financial sustainability of these churches. So we have 62,000 square feet in my church, which is larger. I get that. But there's a church an hour and a half north of us that likes to brag about the fact that they can fit a 737 in their foyer. That's literally what they say.
Have they tried it?
No, they have not tried it. But it is big. So their foyer is like 75,000 square feet. So it's something like that. I know that their foyer, and I have a larger church, like 62,000 square feet is a decent sized campus, don't get me wrong. It's not giant, but it's pretty big. My campus, my entire campus is smaller than their foyer. So let's talk about this. I had a church builder. We partner with a lot of church builders at Church Answers because I'm not an architect. And I had one of them tell me once, and I don't know how true this is. It was more like a general number than an actual like study. But the point was made, and if this number isn't exactly right, it's close. He told me this. He said, Sam, 90% of the cost of a building will occur after you build it. Think about that. So there are churches that have built $100 million campuses. Over the lifespan of that building, how much is that going to cost the church? Do the math in your head. Anybody?
A lot.
$1 billion. $1 billion. A lot of these mega churches, they've been built, they've grown, then all of a sudden deferred maintenance is going to hit. Some of you are like, yeah, we have 5,000 square feet and that roof, woo, yeah, you know, that's like, it's going to be expensive. So my church, 62,000 square feet. Now, if you've heard me on the podcast, don't answer if you know the answer. We were just told, and we've just finished this project actually, so it was a couple years ago, hey, you need to redo all of your air conditioning units. So give me a guess. We've got 62,000 square feet under air. How much was this air conditioning project? Anybody? 50, just guess. Huh?
50,000.
Okay, 50,000. Anybody else?
3 million.
3 million? 1.3 million. Anybody else?
1.25 million.
$2.2 million. $2.2 million. Now, it's Florida. We have a chiller system. We have to run super cool water through the walls because that's just how you have to do commercial grade air conditioning systems in Florida. $2.2 million. Now, this church that's an hour and a half north of us, that is 10 times our size. 20, 30, 40, $50 million for air conditioning. I did a consultation with the mega church. This was pre-COVID, so this is a pre-COVID number. Did a big consultation with the mega church. Great church. Honestly, they're doing really well. They're doing a lot of good things. It's one of those mega churches that I would say, hey, they're actually good. You know, let's not knock them. They're doing really good stuff. And so I was talking with their executive pastor. I could tell he was a little dejected. I was like, man, you've had so much success. Like, this is great. What are you guys going to do next? And he's like, well, Sam, let me be real with you. He goes, carpet. I said, carpet. Hallway carpet. So hallway carpet. So that's what's next. Hallway carpet. He goes, yeah, it's going to cost us $1 million. For hallway, high traffic area carpet. $1 million. There's probably $2 million now. That's how big this campus is. Massive, massive campus. Just high traffic areas. So, and he's like, Sam, we're losing our millennials. Because they think it's a waste of money. They would rather that money go to missions. What church can do that? Your church can do that. Your church can say, you know what? Yeah, we're going to have to fix the AC. Yeah, we're going to have to put a new roof on. But guess what? We still have money for missions. We still have money you look at these large churches, and are they filled with resources? Yes, yes, they are. But they're going to get to a point, like if the church was built 20, 25 years ago, as a lot of these mega churches are, they're just now hitting that deferred maintenance mark. And a lot of them are really struggling. It's like they have 3,000 people. And you would think, man, what a successful church. And you talk to their pastors, and they're like, I don't know if we're going to make it. Because we don't have the money for air conditioners. We don't have the money for a roof. We don't have the money for whatever it may be. And now this space is really, really dated, and we need to paint it all. And guess what? You can't have a paint the church day. Because you would need 4,000 people to get it done. Why might the neighborhood church make a comeback? Reality of real estate. Hospitality. Financial sustainability. The stigma of small is going away, too. It used to be, I'd go to Southern Baptist Convention, and I'd be like, Brother Sam, what you running? Which means, like, what's your worship count? And everything was based on that number, right? And if you weren't growing and big or whatever, but that mentality is not nearly as prevalent. There's really the stigma of small is not there anymore. In fact, You know, there's this shop local, boutique, you know. Let's support the local sandwich shop. Let's support the local church. That's to your benefit. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be careful how I say this. Some of the most uncreative churches on the planet are these large mega churches. How many At the Movie series are we going to see?
Yeah.
It's like, we're so creative. I'm like, you're just doing what everyone else has been doing. It's like these large churches are like, no, you're McDonald's. Now, McDonald's is great. Cheeseburger, no onions, extra pickle. I had away from Detroit in here. I had McDonald's. I liked it. You guys have the opportunity to truly be creative, do something different and specific to your neighborhood. So the stigma of small is going away. There's a return to local preferences. Work from home's a thing. I know that, you know, a lot of people are returning to the office, but there's a lot of hybrid work out there now. So people are not, we'll get to this here in a second, people aren't driving as much. Again, to your benefit. You also have the opportunity to do targeted ministry. So let's put aside megachurch. Let's talk regional church, because not all regional churches are megachurch size, but they have this model of ministry like, we're going to pull people from the entire region, right? That's what we're going to do. And that's a fair way of doing ministry. I hope God doesn't call me away from my church. I love my church. But you know, if you were to call me to like this larger church that's like near the two interstates where they connect. Well, even if that's not a mega church, that's still like a regional church model. You're not in a neighborhood. You're like, you drive by on the interstate as you're moving from one to the next, and it's like, well, I can see the campus, right? Some churches have that model. And I don't know that that's a bad model. But here's the thing about the regional church. Like, we're going to pull from from far away distances. You can't do like local high school ministry. Right? Because there's like 60 high schools, 40 middle schools, and then 120 elementary schools. Like, if you're a regional church, you can't do focused ministry. But the neighborhood church can. The neighborhood church can say, you know what, we're just going to be at the local elementary school. We're going to be at the local high school. We're going to be at the local middle school. Maybe there's two or three or four of them. We're just going to be in there. The regional church, like, offends people. Like, you're not at my high school, you're not at my middle school. Well, when you're a neighborhood church, you can do that targeted ministry. Just about everyone in my church is from 34209, 34205. Like, we have hardly anybody driving long distances to get to West Bradenton. Part of that's traffic, it's just awful in Florida, it's horrible. Does anybody snowbird in here? Like, have you been down there? Anybody go to spring training this year? It's awful. All of you come down, and then like March is terrible.
We lived in West Palm Beach, I ain't moving back.
It's bad, yeah. So
this is my mother-in-law, I'm not going back.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Talk about the air conditioning with these places, but you're in Hurricane Alley. What do these churches pay for insurance?
We're not insured. Very few churches in Florida have insurance.
Really?
You can't get it.
Yeah.
Just Google home insurance, Florida, and you'll enter into a whole world of drama right there.
So I didn't really pay attention to the Gen Zs, especially, that are flocking to Orthodoxy and Catholicism.
Nope.
I mean, by the millions.
Not true.
All right. So I've seen research.
Nope.
I've seen videos.
Nope.
Right?
So nope.
Tell me why it's not true.
Look at their data. Graphsaboutreligion.com, Ryan Burge, type in Eastern Orthodox Church, young people, Ryan Burge, you'll get those articles. Ryan has completely disproven that theory.
Really?
It's just not true. Now, the Catholic Church is seeing people exit and go to non-denominational churches. Because in Central and South America, when people immigrate to the United States, the Catholic Church is often associated with oppression. Right, now that may not be fair, that may not be a fair thing, but that's how they view it, and so they end up in a non-denominational church. But yeah, there's no massive growth of Orthodox churches.
Ryan
Burge. B-U-R-G-E.
Thank you so much.
Yep. I've seen those articles too. You're not wrong. Like, you're repeating what you've seen other people write.
They've taken over. I'll tell you, these Orthodox freaks have taken over TikTok, Instagram, you name it, right? And they're on there with content. It's good content.
Sure. And could it be that there is a small movement within the Orthodox Church of young people going there? Certainly the case. Does it show up in national data? No, it does not. So they may have an outsized voice on social media, which happens a lot. And it may be a good thing. I'm not saying it's, I'm very happy for people who find God through that. But in terms of national numbers, big, large scale numbers, millions of people, no, it's just not happening.
It seems like with the megachurch phenomenon, there is this kind of bubble bursting with narcissism within pastoral leadership at some level.
There's a, if you really want to dig into that, yes, my buddy is I can get you the research project. He actually did narcissism with large church pastors, and his PhD was so controversial because it basically found that, like, yeah, they're a bunch of narcissists, and they're, because of their narcissism, they're really successful.
It's true. Yes. Yeah. So, but the question was, what are the character qualities needed for pastors to, like, turn around neighborhood churches? You know, like, what are some of the character traits?
I'll give you two. They'll just be more spiritual and then practical here. Shepherd's hand, prophetic voice. You need a shepherd's hand and a prophetic voice. And you need both. And sometimes people need a little more of the shepherd's hand. Sometimes people need a little more of the prophetic voice.
What do you mean by prophetic voice?
Speaking truth. Telling people the truth about themselves, about the community, about what's really happening. But at the same time, doing so with a shepherd's heart or a shepherd's hand. Gentleness, kindness, graciousness, but not compromising what you know to be true.
Speak the truth in love.
Speak the truth in love. Yeah, that's the Bible verse. Yeah.
I have a question. So, from the beginning when you started, you said your church address is important. God brought you there.
Yep.
Are you only talking about the church location? Are you trying to expand in terms of even people addresses where they live?
I tell my people, your home address is not an accident. Yeah. I'm telling you, your church address, now you need to go back to your people and say your home address is not an accident.
Are you finding in research that pastoral care has become one thing for future prophets that is something that millennials, Gen Z is looking for, that is going to need to be a resurgence compared to where boomers were going out to the churches, pastors going to the people, and in a more pastoral care manner is something that is going to, ability is going to need to be coming back.
So less rancher style leadership and more shepherd style leadership, is that, am I paraphrasing that appropriately?
Yeah, like, you know, you going and meeting with people where they are versus people coming to you, and more of meeting them in their, with their personal needs, like, for instance, going and more hospital visits, doing home visits, stuff like that, being more important than some of the other things that are.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a generational divide.
Okay.
I think there's a whole slew of pastors that have always been doing that.
Yes.
They just haven't been getting the attention of some of the larger pastors who don't do that.
I will say that it has become out of practice with within seminary, right?
Okay.
And how we train our pastors on what is important, that pastoral care has been to become more of a backseat and not as important in the big scheme of what we do as pastors. And I feel like it's coming to the forefront again, where one-on-one relationship building is more important than what we do on Sunday.
Okay, I'm with you now. And there's a couple of things to unpack here. One, every hospital visit is an opportunity for the gospel.
Amen.
Because likely you're there with family.
Yes.
And while you don't want to be crude and be like, I know you're hurting, but come to church this Sunday. You know, you're going to get somebody's cell phone likely, And you're going to be following up with them. And at that point, you're going to be able to say, hey, just so you know, we've got a group for you here with some like-minded people that can really help you. And I'd like to get you connected to my life group leader, my Sunday school teacher, whoever it is. So there's that. So every hospital visit is a gospel. If you view it as gospel opportunities and not just care, and there's nothing wrong with caring for people, of course, of course. The other thing that I would caution you against is every sort of discipleship model has to be one-on-one. You will bog yourself down if you're a leader and you're trying to do everything one-on-one. You yourself will become the bottleneck. Your job is to equip the saints for the work of ministry, Ephesians 4:12. So should you go to the hospital? Yes. Should you care for people? Yes. Does that need to make a comeback? Yes. But don't burden yourself and bog your church down with, well, the only model of discipleship is me doing it one-on-one.
Right.
Yeah, you're never going to be successful as a pastor that way.
Of course, there's the training the people up to do it themselves. I think more of the matter is the fact that, you know, like, the relationship building aspect within the congregation.
So, yeah, I mean, I know my max, my personal max is going to be right around 900. Everyone's is a little different. I can't fathom like trying to shepherd 10. You can't shepherd 10,000 people. And even at 900, I've got well trained people like doing all sorts of stuff. But that's the max for me. And I've already told my church, we're at 725, and we get to about 900, we're doing something different. Like, we're not going to stop growing. We're just going to send people out. We're going to plant a church. We're going to go revitalize a church. But that's my max. So, and my buddy on the other side of town, he's got the same thing. You know, his is around 1,100. So his campus holds about 1,100. He's like, Sam, when I hit 1,100, because they're growing pretty rapidly too, they're like, I'm done. Like, that's all I can shepherd. So I don't. There is a myth of exponential growth in churches. You hear these stories at some of these conferences about this church that just grew and just grew and just grew and just grew. Well, if you do the math on exponential growth, it's actually an organization called Exponential, within a few short years, you've won the whole world, and the whole world is your church. Like, it just doesn't, like, statistically, it doesn't make sense. We need to remove that unreasonable, and I have nothing against Exponential. They're about multiplication, I get that. We need to remove the unreasonable expectation that your church can just double every year. Like, no, it can't possibly do that. You have 500 people in your community, or 5,000 people in your community. You're only going to, there is a max point that you will hit. Now, that doesn't mean you stop growing or you give up or you get complacent. It just means you have to do something different. So, yes, to pastoral care within a framework that works. And everyone's going to, you know, someone's max maybe 200 or 800 or, you know, wherever that is. And then you grow by multiplying at that point. So I think you're on to something. I think that that's 100% true. And I don't think that we need to burden churches with this idea that, hey, you've got to double every year. Well, some may, and that's great if you do. But some may not.
Just a question, because some of the things we've been talking about makes me think of my daughter's church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And because they were planted about 7 years ago, and they've had the exponential growth. And obviously it can't keep going, but they've had that kind of growth. They've already planted another church within Grand Rapids. And that's one of their things, is they exist to send people out. You're talking about, you get 900, you're sending people out. And one of the things that I found interesting, and a long introduction, is they are very clear that that's what they're about. They will tell you, everyone is welcome here, but we're not for everyone.
Yeah.
Our mission is this. Any thoughts on having sort of that mission statement for the church and getting people to understand everybody's welcome, but this is what we're about, and if you're about something else, you might.
Oh, I think it's great. Oh, no, I think it's great, particularly if it's another believer, right? And they're like, I don't know, I'm just going to use an example. I'm really into Awana. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's a great program.
Yeah.
The Bright curriculum writer, if you use Bright, is at my church. You know, she's a member of my church, so I think very highly of the group, but we'd use Bright. We don't use Awana. We don't teach Awana. We do something different. It's like, well, you can't come here and like that be your thing, because it's not our thing. So all that you're talking about is a filter. And there's nothing wrong with having set expectations and a filter, and of course your church isn't going to be for everyone. You have the desire to reach everyone because you know that anyone can be saved. But at the same time, you also have a framework for your church, and if somebody doesn't fit that framework, you kindly and graciously try to get them to another church that fits them better. I'm a conservative evangelical, and I teach that in my church, and I tell people when they come, like, listen, I love you. I don't have enemies. I will shepherd anybody in this community. If they need help, we're here for them. But in order to become a member of our church, you have to believe in certain fundamentals of the faith. And if you don't, we love you. You're not our enemy. But let us help you get to another church. So whatever that filter is for you, every church is going to be different because your campus size dictates that, your programs dictate that, your doctrine dictates that. And when the Presbyterians come to my church, I'm like, guess what? You're going to have to be immersed, you know, because we're Baptist, you know. And then the Methodists come and they're like, yeah, we had a choice or whatever. And I don't know you guys, I'm not here to debate the mode of baptism, but you get my point. There's nothing wrong with having standards, expectations, and a framework. And I think that will benefit churches because now you know who you are. Yeah. And that identity is a good thing. And it may be different than the church down the road, who you love. And that's okay. That's okay. One more question, then we're right at time.
Okay, well, you spoke about the millennials who left because of the carpet and they tried to do missions. So do you have data that supports them actually going to churches that are emphasizing missions? Churches like, not the mega ones, but our little ones in rural villages that have burnt down all the restaurants, so we have no place to meet, but we have our 150-year-old church, and will they seek out a church that's doing missions to the local community?
No.
Okay.
No.
So that's not a big thing.
Well, that would be a very mature Christian who's seeking out a church just because they do missions. That's pretty rare. That's pretty rare. People come to your church because they were invited. Most people will show up at your church because you're invited. Now, when millennials see waste and what they view as like non-mission related expenditures, yeah, that can be a problem for them. And honestly, with my generation, I don't mind institutional givers because, frankly, we need somebody to like put brick and mortar up. Like, it was built at some point. We need people to do that. So I'm not saying that the millennials have that right either. But will somebody just seek out a church just because of like what the missions budget is? It'd be a pretty rare person to do that. Will they leave if they think the church is being wasteful? Yeah. Yeah. So it's more an exit than it is an entrance, unfortunately. But you bring up a great point. Missions should be a priority of the church.
Yeah, especially in a small town. I mean, we're trying to think, what is it they need?
Yep.
Will it bring people who won't come for an answer because we have a great pastor?
Pastor has very little to do with why people end up at a church. Yeah, it's were they invited by somebody? It's did somebody invite me? I mean, I hate to say it, it's like 80% of people are at a church. Why? Because somebody invited me. That's it.
But they won't stay if they don't get good.
They got to get connected. In order to stay, they have to get connected.
And a good message and connection.
Correct. Now, what keeps them is several different things. Yeah. But why are they there in the first place? Somebody invited me. All right, guys, we're a little past time. I know you got to go to your next thing. I'll hang around if you want to talk. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Hey, Sam, can I preach in your pulpit? Can you preach in my pulpit?
Yeah.
I was willing to sit on the floor.
It's a music stand.
Well, I've got these fast